Welcome to the Cosmosis Podcast. This is episode number 35, and we have a returning guest today. And I'll be telling you about him in just a second, but a little housekeeping before we get to that. I do want to apologize for not posting a podcast in a while. I had put out on Facebook for people to send in their questions, but it was my wedding week, and I had thought that I could possibly get to it, and then that was pretty silly because there's no way that was going to happen. So I will get around to that eventually, and I owe everybody that podcast as well. Do be sure to like the Cosmosis Podcast Facebook page, and I have a music artist page myself. It's facebook.com/JustinMoses. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram. Be sure to leave a review and a rating on iTunes, and be sure and share the show on your social media. We don't have a big advertising budget up in here, so it helps. Every little bit helps. But today we have, as I said, returning guest Tom Utes. You can go back and revisit his other episode and learn a lot more about him. But today I wanted to do a podcast based on a topic, and the topic today is recording. And so, Tom, thanks for doing this.
Sure, glad to be here. I hope I have something to contribute, something meaningful.
I think you do.
All right.
Well, first of all, like I mentioned, we did the other show, and we covered, like, a lot of bio information in that, but one piece of it that we could revisit just because of what we want to talk about today is how you got into recording.
Sure. Well, like a lot of people, I started with a four-track cassette machine, and then upgraded from there to an eight-track half-inch tape machine. And then I was probably around 20 or 21 at that time, and I had a friend that I played in a band with who had a studio, and we went into business together, and we had a 16-track two-inch machine, which I wish we still had, but we sold it about 15 years ago for $500, because at the time, nobody thought that that was ever going to be en vogue again. And that was back in Germany where I grew up, and we recorded bands. We recorded a lot of audio for computer games and stuff like that, a lot of instrumental music. And then we sort of parted ways, and I had my own setup over there for a while, but at that point I knew that I was going to move to the States. So once I moved here, I got set up in our first house in a duplex, and set one side of the duplex up for recording. And, you know, always collected more gear and stuff. And then when we moved out here, where we still are, we added on to this house. So the studio was going to be a little bigger. And now it's actually a pretty good size place with four different rooms where you can record pretty comfortably with a 4-5-piece band. And so that's about how I got into it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you record a lot of singer-songwriters and a ton of different styles and everything. How did you sort of get a clientele sort of built up?
Well, as with a lot of things, it's hard for me to backtrack and go like, this is what I did, and then this is what followed. It's all coincidence in some ways. I think what made things work for me is the fact that I'm not just quote-unquote an engineer, but that I have the studio, I'm a guitar player, I have contacts to good players, I'm typically producing this stuff, not just engineering it, so people get a lot of bang for their buck, if you will. And I'm good at organizing the whole thing, I'm good at writing charts, I do all of that. Mm-hmm. And I think I have a sensibility for acoustic music that certain singer-songwriter types appreciate. It's probably more and more getting toward acoustic-based stuff because I'm not super young and also not super hip, and I'm not necessarily interested in the tones du jour because I have a feeling that those tones are very often very time-stamped, and I would rather work with tones that are not time-stamped, and acoustic instruments to me are not.
Right, right. Okay. So I, you know, mentioned when we were talking about doing this, I wanted to talk about just what recording is, you know, just the idea of it, because some people get somewhat jaded idea of it in certain ways. Like I've heard tracks that were recorded just with little stereo microphones, you know, from a thing that just sound awesome.
Absolutely.
And it's just a matter of what you're doing is you're trying to capture audio.
I think more than anything, you're trying to capture a performance, or you should try to capture a performance.
Right, yeah.
I mean, I want my stuff to sound good, and I like good audio gear and like good microphones and all that kind of stuff. But I'm keenly aware of the fact that it's mostly the performance that matters. So I try not to waste a lot of time with setting up and having people sit around and get bored or lose energy before we get going. I want it to be intuitive and quick on everybody's end. I think recording, I mean, it's as simple as that. It's capturing sound, and that's also an endlessly complicated question. I mean, what is the best fiddle tone? What's the best guitar tone? It's actually, to me, it's a Zen-like question in Zen Buddhism. There is a koan, a question, an unanswerable question what's the sound of one hand clapping?
Mm-hmm.
And you can't answer it, but you can think about it for a long time. And that's, to me, it's the same with recording, you know. So,
well, I wanted to ask too. So, just in general terms, like, you know, you hear tone thrown out a lot, like let's get tones or let's you know whatever. But try to explain that to people that that may not even know what that means exactly.
Well,
what do we mean when we say tones?
Well, I think on the most basic level, we mean level. Play something so I can hear how loud your instrument is, so I know how far away or close in to move my microphone, and how much I have to crank my preamp or my compressor or whatever. On a more advanced level, I think it means listening to a particular instrument and trying to understand where the sweet spot of the instrument is, where it's a little warmer, where the attack is, where whatever, and then honing in on that and trying to me, that directly, that's in correspondence with the personality of the player. So, you know, if you would play a certain mandolin, I would probably approach it a little differently than if somebody else would play it, you know.
So
that's what I think what we're talking about when we're talking about tones. And that's the tones of the individual instruments. Then there's the question of how do those tones relate to each other once they're all blended together, or once they all play together.
Right.
At that point, it also becomes a matter of, it goes into arrangement, it goes into audio engineering, it goes into a lot of different directions at that point, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about for a second, you just recorded an album.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the process, how it starts, basically, I guess, from wherever you see the starting point.
Right. Well,
I mean, for you, let me throw this out there. It probably starts with the fact that you have songs you've written.
Correct.
Yeah.
The songwriting is becoming more and more important more and more important part of my life, career, whatever you want to call it. So I have a lot of songs. So when I think about making a record, I have to think about what do I want to say? What is this supposed to do for me as an artist, as a studio owner, as a songwriter? And then I have to go through those songs and see what I want to do. I mean, obviously I knew that I wanted to make a bluegrass record because that's where my head and heart has been at for the last 15 years or something. So there was no issue about that. Then I have to think about, I'll go through my songs. I have probably 500-600 songs that I've weed through. Some have been recorded. So I have to decide, do I want to re-record some stuff that's already been recorded because I had a good year with getting a lot of cuts? Do I want to showcase that? Or would I rather record stuff that nobody's heard yet? Do I want to focus on a specific themes lyrically? Do I want it to be really traditional? Do I want it to be more rhythmical? Do I want it to be harmonically more advanced? And once I pick the songs, I have to think about personnel, or one issue is always, do I want to have a drummer on it? Do I not want to have a drummer on it? So on this record, I decided I was not going to do that. Not because I'm scared that some people are not going to like that or anything, but it was just something that I hadn't done to that extent, and I really wanted to do that and explore what rhythmic variety we could come up with. And if I could, as somebody who didn't grow up in that tradition, if I could get a result that I define as very hard driving in a traditional sense. Mm-hmm. So that was one challenge that I set for myself. So after that, I have to decide, how do I want to set up the band? You know, I've actually for a while thought I would really like to make a record with a stereo ribbon mic. Mm-hmm. Just put everybody around it and play. Like they did 50 years ago. Those are the tones that we're still kind of, in a way, chasing down.
Yeah.
And now we have ribbon mics that are so much, maybe not better, but they're more reliable and less fragile. And so that's something I thought about for a while. But then I thought, well, if you want to get any kind of airplay, you limit your possibilities quite a bit right there, because it's just going to sound so radically different from everything else that's out there that people are probably going, some people are going to be scared of it. Mm-hmm. So I decided not to do that, but I decided, because I'm really interested in ribbon mics at the moment, that I was going to use a lot of ribbon mics on this record, which I did, and I really enjoy doing that at the moment. So at that point, we're talking about what mics am I using, what preamps am I going to use with which mic, what do I have available, how much money do I want to spend on new gear, how much money do I want to spend on renting gear. Mm-hmm. If I rent gear, I'm not going to know that gear as well as I know mine. So, you know, I'm somebody who, it takes me a long time to get to know a piece of gear really well. There's people who can learn that really quickly, and I can't. It takes me a long time to mess around with a piece and figure out what it's really good at or what I like it at. So I think a lot of, to me, getting ready for a recording session like that is a process that's, it's not something that I do when I sit down with a piece of paper and make up my mind within half an hour. It's something that I carry around for a long time, conceptualize, think about, at the same time not over-conceptualize, so I'm still open to new ideas and the moment, whatever presents itself in the moment. Then the next step for me was to decide, do I want to record this with a click track? Do I want to record this with a click track and me laying down a guide guitar and a vocal to that click track and then have everybody play to that? Or do I want to play with the band and sing with the band? I decided to lay down a click track and then lay down one or two guide guitars and a vocal, simply because I'm also the engineer here, so it would probably get a little overwhelming for me to engineer, sing and play, judge whatever my performance is, whatever the player's performance is, or give my input to that, because I never try to judge what the people that I book, what they play. I don't even ask for a specific thing necessarily. I just want them to know that I trust them pretty much infinitely, and that through that I hope to encourage a performance that they put their personality in. As, I mean, you know how we've worked here a lot, so you know how that it's. I'm trying to keep it pretty open.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, definitely.
So I mean, that's already a whole lot of stuff, and then this is getting pretty detail oriented. But then, if the band plays to my guide guitar and guide vocal and a click track, then sometimes I go back and go like, well, okay, now I don't like my guitar anymore. So, but then I'm playing to the way you play to my original guitar, which is sort of backwards. So I have to really be careful to interpret that correctly and figure out what I need to do to enhance my performance, but at the same time not be too selfish to go, well, I might be able to play the solo better, but then it's going to mess with the whole rhythmical microcosm that's there. So It's pretty detailed, and I like that a lot. You know, I've learned a lot making this record, although I've been recording, you know, for over 20 years now. But this has been a real good learning curve for me. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I can't even tell you why. It's not like one thing happened. Oh, I learned something. But you wake up sometimes and you go like, I hear attack and release from this compressor differently now. Uh-huh. And there's no way to I can't explain why that is, but it is that way.
Mm-hmm. Constant learning process, right?
I hope so. I mean, that's one of my goals. If it wouldn't be that, then why would you want to do it? Yeah. You know, I mean, then it'd be just turn something on and off. That's not very interesting.
Well, so that was sort of the process of the recording with that record.
Right.
Now, people come in here and they have all kinds of different ideas of how they should record.
Right.
So maybe describe a couple of the other ways that people come in here and do that. I mean, beyond just, either using a click track or not, which is a big issue for a lot of people,
sure.
You know. There's a lot of situations where it makes sense for somebody to definitely use it. It makes sense to me a lot of times to not, if you want to, you know, have a natural, if you're recording like more of a band or if you're recording, you know, something that is worked out, I guess might be the way to put it. I'm not sure.
Right.
You can do either with either thing, but beyond that, like just even coming in here and recording a very live feel, do you have many people that do that?
Well, my experience is that a lot of singer-songwriter people come in and say, I want to do something that sounds like such and such a Guy Clark record or a mm-hmm. I Love It record. And then you go like, okay, well, I get that. And then you get them in here and it turns out that that's not really what they want. That's what they think they want.
Uh-huh.
But as some people get, if it's even the slightest little bit loose, they lose confidence and they mm-hmm. they think something's wrong. And you try to explain to them, well, you know, Guy Clark didn't record that record to a click track. He probably mm-hmm. never recorded anything to a click track. So that's what you get. And a lot of people want to, it's really tricky. You have to figure out a lot of it in advance by talking to people and by listening to the demos that they send in and then figure out what's the discrepancy between what they want mm-hmm. and what they can actually do.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's delicate. Sometimes you have to tell people you really shouldn't be playing the guitar in that because you're throwing us. You're throwing us off.
Yeah.
We'll put your guitar on later and let you play to these guys. But I mean, you know, it's a tricky thing. It's if you're not playing with a band all the time or to a click track all the time, there's no way you can just waltz into a pretty what's for a lot of people who record, you know, only occasionally, is a pretty high pressure situation because mm-hmm. they're spending money. There's really, really good players around them. All of a sudden, and they have to deliver, and that's not so easy, you know.
Right.
So you have to take that pressure off people, but you also have to accept what they say they want, and then have to figure out what's the discrepancy between what they can want and what they can achieve, and how can I help them to make that happen. Which is more of the producer's role, to create an environment where everybody's happy, where I'm mm-hmm. respectful with the time of the players that are here. You know, if somebody comes in here and he has never recorded and he wants to record six versions of every song, we're not going to get done in the time that I calculated, which means that people are not making the kind of money that they need to be making per hour or whatever the arrangement is. And then, so it's all kinds of stuff that goes into that, you know.
Well, you mentioned something that I also find interesting, and that's the role of the producer. There are producers that there's such a wide range of what somebody defines as a producer.
Absolutely.
Some people just I've been on sessions before where the producer is literally he does nothing but just observe and either be like, yeah, that's good, or mm-hmm. Or that's about it in some cases, you know, even not even giving a lot of suggestion. But then there are producers that are involved from the get-go and are involved with picking the songs and all that. Do you have much to
I think that the role of the producer has changed in many different ways over the last 40, 50 years. I mean, traditionally it used to be that the producer was responsible for getting the record company something that they can sell. Mm-hmm. So he needed to get a singer in, find the songs, find the players that this guy can work with, and get a product that the label can sell and make their money back on. Now the producer, to the way I see myself as a producer and the kind of work that I'm getting is I would call myself more of a facilitator. Mm-hmm. I provide the room, I book the players, which is traditionally the role of the producer is to book the players. But I also write the charts. I listen to the demos that are being turned in. I give my input to the songs. I talk to the people ahead of time, explain the process to them if they're not familiar with it. Discuss players, whatever sonic vision they have, approach, all of that. The role of the producer also changes with what kind of music you're going to record. What we're doing here, as you know, is typically harmonically not very complicated stuff. So it's the role of the musicians is mostly based on their instinct, you know, right. Just play what you think works to that and something that, you know, but just something that's appropriate for that. If we'd be working on a soundtrack for a movie or something, my role would be different. We'd have to look at things differently. We'd have to discuss things differently. If you and I would, for instance, work on an instrumental record, we'd probably approach things differently mm-hmm. and get much more in depth into play this, let's not do this, do that.
Orchestrating,
correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I do a lot of work for, as you know, for TV and movie on assignment where they tell me, we need 7 songs like this, do this. Mm-hmm. Well, I produce, I'm the producer on those sessions too, but I have to approach that completely differently because right. now I have to create something that they can sell not to the, to an audience per se in terms of fans, but to TV and movie. And I need to make sure that certain elements of media music production are being respected so they can use it. And in turn, I can, you know, make more money on it, mm-hmm. off it. So right. there's many different ways.
Right. Let's, I'm kind of going to be going all over the place, but let's turn now and kind of look at just some of the records that we've both like heard, or I'm not trying to limit it to what we both have, but what are some of your favorite that you think are the most well recorded albums, first of all in any genre, and then we'll kind of limit it down maybe and say in acoustic bluegrass ish sort of records.
That's also something that's tricky for me to say. I mean, there's records that are, objectively speaking, incredibly well recorded, like Crime of the Century by Supertramp, for instance, is an incredibly well recorded album, but it's not something I've listened to in the last 20 years.
All right.
There's certain things by Led Zeppelin that I, when we're talking about drum sounds and stuff like that, that I think are absolutely incredible. But I'd also have to say that, you know, if you're talking about the craft of recording, if you listen to mid-late 80s Bon Jovi stuff before drum replacing, before sampling and all that, to get that much energy on tape required incredible skill on the mm-hmm. on the behalf of the engineer. Now, that's not my personal musical taste. If we're talking about my musical taste, I would say, you know, the way my... I'm sure it's similar for a lot of other people, but with me, I start somewhere and then I typically go back from there. So when I was in my teens and listened to a lot of Eric Clapton and blues rock guitar players, I went back to from there to Muddy Waters, from there to Robert Johnson, mm-hmm. from there to, you know, right. Charlie Patton and so on. So when I'm talking about the stuff that influenced me in terms of acoustic music and bluegrass stuff, I'd have to say that, you know, I mean, all of the Alison Krauss stuff is the gold standard. I would almost say obviously, mm-hmm. because it's so obvious that it's just the quality of the voices and the players and the quality of the instruments and the quality of the engineering and the gear that was used. I mean, it's just, and it evolved too. And it evolved in a really, really great, interesting way. And then, so that's a huge influence on me. Then obviously the whole Tony Rice catalog is a huge influence on me, not just the playing and the singing, but also the way it's been recorded. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to, you know, I don't want to say the wrong thing here, but it's almost like it seems that in bluegrass music, there was a cutoff point where people started paying attention to the way it was recorded. And before that, it seemed like, well, let's just get in there and, mm-hmm. and play.
Yeah.
The exception probably is Jimmy Martin stuff, which sounds unbelievably great. I mean, you can listen to Prayer Bells in Heaven, and it sounds absolutely incredibly great. And it's, to me, the first bluegrass stuff where you can really evenly hear the bass, where it's, you can, you know, he had this vision of putting the snare drum in, but it's not overpowering the mandolin. It's just incredibly great. Mm-hmm. And I think it has a lot to do with him and how he heard it and how he wanted it.
Mm-hmm. I would have to say that, like, Allison's So Long, So Wrong record captured some of the best tones, if you want to, you know, put it in those terms, that, you know, to this day, and a new favorite, the one after that.
Like, totally.
And that's not to slight the ones that have been released since. It's just that those really strike me as having certain qualities, especially like the banjo tone on So Long, So Wrong is probably my absolute favorite. Adam's mandolin tone on that record also was just incredible.
It's super interesting to listen to that stuff and then listen to Paper Airplane, and I've read a couple of things about it, what their vision was, how they wanted to change things up for that record, and mm-hmm. how they realized that, you know, I mean, how they mm-hmm. how they made it happen. It's just incredible.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I mean, there's Gary Pagliuca is super, I mean, that's a guy I totally look up to, and Bill Mornick is a guy that I totally look up to. Those are people who really totally understand all that stuff on him in a who totally understand all the physics of all of that, which I don't. With me, it's all instinct, and mm-hmm. you know, that's good and bad. It's right. but those guys are like the top of the heap in my book.
Okay, well, let's talk now about say there's a young artist or band, like either way, getting, or they have some songs they want to record. Maybe do you have some advice you could give as far as pre-planning? Because it's important to have a plan for what's going to happen after the record. As you know, it's almost as important, if not as important, to have a plan for what you're going to do with it once you have it done. Like, you can have a great record, but what are you going to do with it?
Well, that's the million-dollar question at this point, you know. I think it's possible to have a plan that reflects your what's possible for you.
Yeah.
You know, and you have to be realistic about that. And that's something I have a lot of singer-songwriter people that I make records with that before we go in the studio, they tell me, I'll ask him, so what do you want to do with this? Are those demos? Is that going to be an artist record for you? And very often the answer is, well, it's going to be an artist record, but if you know somebody that you want to pitch these to, that'd be great. And I immediately tell people that's not what I do. It's not mm-hmm. what even if I wanted to do it, I couldn't do it. you have to be honest with people about that kind of stuff and not lure them into, you know, yeah, sure, I'll pitch your songs to whoever. I mean, it's just mm-hmm. not going to happen. So I'm just, I don't know. I mean, you know, that's you can only get involved in it so much, you know. So I'm not going to tell people, well, this is, also because I might be wrong. You know, I might tell mm-hmm. somebody, hey, I don't see any chances to get, I mean, what do I know about contemporary country music or singer-songwriter Americana world? I pretty much know nothing. Mm-hmm. I also don't care much about it. And that's not out of arrogance. It's just, it's just not my taste. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's too much stuff going on that's where it feels to me that the music is sold to the people on the back of the artist's lifestyle, which I find incredibly boring.
Yeah. So. Right. So having a plan going in is very important. Talk about the the pre-planning you do as a musician, as a player, that would prepare you to perform in the studio?
Well, I think for the artist, it's really important to come in here or into any studio, and although it might sound like stating the obvious, but it's apparently not, really know your songs. Mm-hmm. Really, you know, it's better if you have the lyrics memorized than if you have to read them. Know your arrangements. If we change the arrangements in pre-production a couple days or weeks before the session, make sure that you take notes of that. Make sure that you remember that. The less we have to talk about how long is the intro again or how long is the solo, the better. And the better the flow is going to be, the easier it's going to be on the players and all of that. So on that level, I think you can't be prepared enough, but you also have to leave mental space for change. You know, you might have a drummer who goes like, man, I just don't feel it that, but let's play this whole thing in halftime. And you at least have to be open enough to go like, all right, let's try it, you know.
And generally speaking, probably the more experienced and the more kind of seasoned of a player or musician that you would have coming in, the more prepared they're going to just naturally be.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. But it's a good thing to keep in mind. It's a different skill to come in and play and have everything scrutinized on the level that it is.
Sure. I mean, the studio is the big equalizer. You know, you might be able to play something at home, but that doesn't mean that you can do it in a situation where other people are watching you, where there's all of a sudden a different rhythmic element that you're dealing with and all of that. So
what can you do to prepare? Like, besides, I think the first obvious thing is to play with a metronome, to
sure.
practice with playing with one, just to improve your own
right.
sense of timing and your ability to play with
right.
it.
Right. Well, I think it varies from whatever style of music you're working in. Most singer-songwriters think that it's a matter of pride not to work with a metronome, that something mm-hmm. gets lost when you're working with a metronome. Well, something only gets lost if you can't do it. If you can right. do it, it doesn't matter, because mm-hmm. you're not listening for it, you're not looking for it, it's just there, mm-hmm. and you're playing with it. If we're talking about, you know, more bluegrass-related artists, I think it's a good idea to have at least certain basic ideas about your solos and sort of have that not like completely ironed out, but have it mapped out. Mm-hmm. So you know what you want to showcase about your playing, you know what you can do in terms of speed and accuracy. Also, I think it's really important to know what standards you want to apply to your own playing. Right. And that's ultimately only the player can decide that. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I'm playing guitar tracks on my own stuff, I'm incredibly picky about it. And I very often need somebody else to go like, no, this is fine, or this is not cool. But it has to be a reflection of what you're actually able to do, mm-hmm. you know. So I can't be picky to the extent that I can't physically do something. And I think developing right. an awareness of that is important for any player. Yeah, you know?
It is, and it's something that I can say that for me, I've been recording since. Well, I mean, the first time I ever stepped foot in the studio, I was like 8, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm still, I think, learning to a certain extent to try to hone in on, well, what can I expect from myself without being too hard on myself, like expecting more than what I'm, like you said, physically capable of doing, but at the same time, trying to have a good standard for yourself too.
Absolutely.
You know?
I don't have any answers for that. I'm always looking. I mean, my attitude towards those things and my mindset is always changing, and mm-hmm. I question my approach all the time. And I think you have to be artistically healthy, right. but you shouldn't let it drive yourself crazy or limit your creativity at the same time. Mm-hmm. So that's where music becomes a very spiritual thing to me, where these are things that are not answerable in clear terms. So right. you can only approach them metaphorically, if you will, and that's, you know, it's not easy to do. And I would love to be able to creep into the mind of players that that I love and follow their thought process and processes and learn how they approach that, how happy they are with the result of their efforts, certain efforts that they've made. I would like to know how much, well, let's take Tim Stafford. I'd like to know how far he, for instance, wants to still go. How much, and I assume he wants to push himself as far as he can, but what does that mean for him?
Right.
What does that mean? Does it mean accuracy? Does it mean a different approach rhythmically? Does it mean thinking more advanced harmonically? Not that it's not advanced enough already, but I assume there's things that people want to do,
right,
you know?
Right.
And how does it feel? How do they think about it? How obsessed are they over it? Is that the stuff that they think about at 3 o'clock at night, you know?
Yeah. Or, well, it's interesting to think about how pleased different people may or may not be with where they're at, regardless of how great you think they are.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, I know, I mean, people sometimes are very nice to me about my playing, but there's definitely times where I, you know, for my own sake, I'm not really happy with it because I'm not not still where I want to be.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it changes on a daily basis for me, especially in the studio. There's days, especially because I have to work on them just because of the nature of the stuff that I do and this setup, I often work by myself and work on tracks by myself for other people or projects or whatever. There's days where I come in here at 10 o'clock and start playing guitar and something, and it literally takes me 20 minutes to play the first two bars because I'm questioning the way I feel about the click. Mm-hmm. That issue would not be there if there'd be four other people around me that I play with, because it's just like, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, let's play.
Yeah.
But it changes when you're by yourself.
Yeah.
And
there's definitely a different mentality of like playing and recording by yourself than it is with people.
And you simply because you hear it differently too, you know. But it's also, well, and then there's days where you start playing and you go, that feels really good. There's days when you play on something for an hour and you go, it feels terrible. Mm-hmm. And you listen back and you go, yeah, but it sounds good. Mm-hmm. I've learned to not drive myself too crazy anymore. So if something's really bothering me and I can't seem to get it, I'll walk away for 10 minutes or something, or check my email, come back, listen to it. Most of the time, it's at the very least acceptable. And most of the time, it's good. And then I'll try to beat it. Mm-hmm. And then once I try to beat it, I'll pretty much know whether I can or not.
Right.
But it depends on what physical level of playing we're talking about. For me, because I'm not the greatest bluegrass player, there are certain things that if I want to play them right, I need to warm up at least 30 to 45 minutes to get up to dexterity, level of dexterity where I can physically even do that.
Yeah.
And it's not because it's so demanding. It's because I'm not such a good player for this kind of stuff.
Well, one of the things that I'm hypersensitive to is pitch, and that seems...
Sure.
It's almost like a dichotomy for me, because that's something that I also felt like I'm not the greatest at necessarily. Right. Like with a fiddle in particular would be the instrument that I think of.
Mm-hmm.
But there's such a fine line sometimes between that being an issue of it being bad or an issue of, hey, it's great. It's like within what's acceptable. And like, there's been times where I would have been worried about, I'll just say, for instance, when we were doing Wheels with Dan Tominski, and, you know, we were mixing, I think, and I was like, I don't know about that note, you know, like that seems pitchy or whatever. And he pointed out to me, well, I've listened to Bobby Hicks, for instance, on records that I love and that I, you know, adore. Like, not every note is exactly, you know what
sure.
I mean? Like, you, it's hard to judge your own self, though, as far as, like, what inaccuracies or whatever. You know, like, I've said this before on here, but, like, you know, there's no reason I should feel like I need to be a perfect musician. I'm not a perfect person. Nobody is. So
right.
It's like a matter of trying to capture your best self, I
right.
guess. But what are your thoughts on that?
I mean,
the same thing applies to singing, and singing probably in a, it's more personal, it's more
right.
applicable to that than it is anything else.
Well, intonation is obviously incredibly important. It's incredibly important to me. I think our sense of intonation has changed over the last 10, 15 years because everything, most of what we hear is tuned mathematically so mm-hmm. correctly that we're hearing everything so, especially the major thirds, so sharp. It's actually not the way they're supposed to sound. I mean, when you can't tune a dobro mathematically correctly and get anything out of it that resembles anything that sounds good. Same with the guitar, really. I mean, you have to tune key specifically, and I struggle with intonation issues quite a bit sometimes. As you know, when we were mixing something last week, I asked you about a specific note that I still hear as sharp, and you go like, no, absolutely not. It's totally fine.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's where you have to let it go and go like, well, let's lean on somebody else. Mm-hmm. If I can't make an educated decision or whatever, a decision that's satisfactory to me, then I'll ask somebody else. With singers, I'm not a great singer, but I know what's in tune and what's not in tune. I know how difficult it is to hear your own voice coming back at you and how uniquely different you hear your own voice coming back at you compared to somebody else's voice. It's infinitely easier for me to make decisions about other people's tuning, timing, everything than about my own.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the nature of the game. That's where music becomes such an incredible metaphor for life, because you have to constantly figure out how far you can push yourself without losing it, without going nuts.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the same with eating, with working out, with playing, with writing, with how you want to interact in a relationship, all of that, you know, and it's all reflected in, music is an incredible metaphor for all of that. But I mean, again, this is where I would like to know how did Tony Rice feel about certain things that he played? Did he go like, well, this is not perfect, but it feels really great? Or is it just, what was the motivation behind leaving this versus trying again? Or, not that there's anything that he should ever play again, but you know what
I'm
talking about. Yeah. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. There's certain things on records that I love where I hear something speed up and I go like, that feels so good.
Yeah.
But if it be my record, I go like, well, that speeds up. And person X is going to go like, well, dude, can't you hear that this is speeding up?
Yeah.
And you don't let yourself have the authority to say, of course it's speeding up, but I like it.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
You know, so.
A lot of the whole mind game around it is knowing exactly what you want out of something.
Right.
Like figuring out how to know what you want about it.
Well, I think it's getting more and more difficult for us to make those decisions because it's come such a long way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's we know so much more stuff. We have access to so many more things that we compare our stuff in terms of playing, intonation, timing, sonic quality to so many more things than people did who played bluegrass music in 1965.
Exactly.
You know, there wasn't so much you could compare yourself to. So, I mean, obviously it's a great asset to have access to all those things and to listen to so much, that to have access to all this incredible music, but it's also also drives us nuts. I don't think that our brains are quite keeping up with all that, with all the availability of stuff that's out there, you know, so.
I would agree. So let's talk for a little bit about mixing, the whole mixing process and what it's like.
Well, I'm frequently getting stuff sent to me to mix for other people. So that's a completely different thing than mixing my own material. If I get stuff from other people, I'll just throw it up and listen a little bit, and I ask people, "What do you like? What are you, you know, what records do you like sonically?"
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I get tracks where I go like, this doesn't make much sense to me, and then I'll ask people, what did you mean by that? Why did you send me two tracks of this? Why did you blah blah blah, and just start hammering away at it. I mean, it's very intuitive. I think one rule of thumb is not to, you know, try if you're talking about EQing stuff, try taking stuff out before you you boost stuff, you know, because that's always going to be a little artificial. The biggest question marks for me are always low end, is it enough or is it too much? And vocal volume is always tricky to judge, and everybody has their own opinions about that. I don't know that I have an opinion. It's just, I don't know that anybody can have. I think you just, you know, you just feel it differently. It depends on the voice of the singer too. And again, I just try to listen to the tone of the instrument and how that relates to the tones of the other instruments, and what can I do with that? You know, mm-hmm. Or sometimes somebody will send you a bass that's not a particularly good upright bass. What are you going to do with that? Or somebody sends you an electric upright thing. Well, what are you going to do with that? I think you have to treat that completely differently than a really, really good sounding upright bass, for instance. Right. I mean, you're masking more and all of that. When I mix my own stuff, I have a pretty good idea how I want it and what I want. And when I'm talking about my own stuff, it's also typically the same players. And I know those instruments so well that I actually do know how that instrument sounds and how I want, when I'm getting close to reflecting that in the way it's mixed, that it's actually matching the natural sound of the instrument. So
in bluegrass, typically that's the goal, is to hear an instrument just like it sounds.
To me, it is, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then there's stuff where if it's a little more aggressive or whatever, sometimes you may want to, you know, add a little more of that lower octave in, so you just have a little more something that sounds a little more aggressive or something. Mm-hmm. But so I just try to position things in the stereo image where I mean I try to visualize how I would set this band up in the room and then mm-hmm. reflect that, and I'm trying to always maintain a balance of like, okay, how loud is a human voice compared to an acoustic guitar? If the acoustic guitar is, you know, somebody's cross picking quietly, how does that change? Somebody's really digging in on a fast bluegrass thing. How does that change the ratio between the human voice and that instrument, and how does that influence the chop of the mandolin and all that? You know, but it's not something that I think about. It's just something that's, as you're working on it, it evolves and mm-hmm. you get closer to it. You obviously look for a certain amount of drive or whatever and try to get that. I really like playing around with, you know, compression, attack and release times, and see how that can. It's amazing how that can bring something out without turning it up. It's just all of a sudden it pops up and it's in a nice spot. Mm-hmm. So, all that. But again, I'm not technical about any of these things. I just play around with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Talk about some of your favorite pieces of gear.
Well, at the moment, over the last year or so, I got super crazy about these AEA ribbon mics. And actually, we're recording this podcast with an R84. I just wanted to, you know, it's those things are, the classic tones, especially when we're talking about vocal sounds and stuff like that. And they're so versatile too, because, you know, because of the figure of eight and because the backside sounds a little different from the front. And so I got a couple of their microphones, and it's really changed my tonal arsenal, especially in terms of drum room sounds. I mean, that stereo R88 that they have is just absolutely killer. I've used this R84 and your banjo and dobro mm-hmm. together with a condenser on this last record, on dobro and on banjo, and it's so much better than without it. And it's mm-hmm. it's just such a natural warmth that it adds. It just makes it big.
Yeah.
And I used pair of small diaphragm condensers on Sierra's mandolin, but also use that R80A on it, and it just blows my mind how it introduces a softness to it and a roundness and adds perspective in terms of where the instrument's coming from and all that. It's super cool. So that's at the moment stuff that I'm really intrigued by and love to play with. It can be somewhat dark, especially on a guitar. It might not be. It'd be really cool on certain singer-songwriter things, but but maybe not necessarily on a bluegrass thing. Super great on upright bass too. Then I have this 1178 URI compressor, which is the stereo version of the 1176, which is a classic compressor, and I've you can play around with that thing quite a bit and get some really cool tones. I've used it pretty heavily on this new record on my vocal, and I'm digging it. And then my favorite preamps are these. I have these two pre's that a friend of mine in Germany, he didn't make them, but he sort of re-racked them. They're old Telefunken V276 preamps, and he put them in a new case, and they're incredibly good-sounding pre's on pretty much anything. And I like stuff that has one or two knobs, where it's just turn it up and see what that does. Mm-hmm. But I also have the studio can obviously be a black hole for money.
Oh, yeah.
So I have a rule that I've never bought anything that I couldn't pay cash for. Mm-hmm. So I don't have a huge mic locker or a huge arsenal of gear, but it's all paid for.
Yeah.
which is worth a lot to me. Mm-hmm. And I also know what this stuff does. And I get nervous when I have a guitar that, for instance, that I don't play all the time. I go like, well, why do I? I'm not rich enough to be a collector. You know, why do I have this? And this is it's the same with audio stuff. If I'm not using it, then there's not really any reason for me to have it,
yeah.
Sit around,
right.
You know. So, and I think that's how I can, on a business level, I can have this make sense, because it's not a black hole for money. You know, it's if it generates an income, it's great. If it doesn't, I'm not freaking out because I can't pay the rent or the what I owe on the gear.
Yeah, exactly. So any closing words?
Well, I think it's important to stretch that it's always, that it's an ongoing process to listen to other people's work and to listen to your own work and to lean on other people and get their input and to further your own game, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
So just having an exchange with other people is important, I think.
To remind people where they can find you online with your social media.
Yeah, it's tommutz.com, TOMMJUTZ.com. And the new record that we talked about quite a bit is going to be released on Mountain Fever Records in mid-October or something like that.
Does it have a title?
It's called Crazy If You Let It.
All right, cool. Well, man, appreciate your time. Appreciate you being willing to do this. And
totally, my pleasure.
Maybe we'll do it even again. So.
Let's do it again.
All right. Thanks. If you enjoyed this show, there are many ways you can contribute to the show. You can share on social media, all your platforms. You can leave reviews and rankings on whatever format you might be listening on. And you can contribute directly at justinmoses.com. Just click the podcast link and you can go from there. And I hope you will come back, or hope you will subscribe so that you'll get all the episodes. But if not, I should be back before too long with another episode. And I'll say so long for now.